Hey, good morning, greetings, and welcome to The Other Animals for November 22nd, 2019. For one, am very, and I don't know about you, but I, for one, am very much looking forward to Thanksgiving. I think we've deserved it this year. For us, it's going to be a bit smaller affairs than the years past. Kids are kind of scattered a little bit further away than they normally would, but that's fine. Thanksgiving has become something of a proven ground for toleration in recent years, it seems to me. These are darker than usual political times. Certainly the country seems the most divided that I can ever remember it. And the Thanksgiving family get-together has come to be sort of a powder keg, just waiting for the proverbial crazy uncle to go off on his rant and light the fuse that sets everyone else off. The absolute polarization, with no middle ground, no room for compromise, seems to come home to roost on Thanksgiving. Bill Maher had some sagely advice for Thanksgiving this past week when he suggested that, quote, "This year, just celebrate Thanksgiving, don't try to win it, and never forget the single shining truth about democracy. It means sharing a country with a-holes you can't stand." End quote. He happens to close the bit with images of a kitten gazing at a duckling, a dog snuggling with what appears to be, I don't even know what this thing is, it looks like a cross between a hippo and a yak, and a mouse hitching a ride on a frog as he intones, "For a country that loves to look at pictures of entirely different species getting along, can't we try it in politics?" What a nice thought. Now, Bill Maher, in case you didn't know it, is an animal guy. He sits on the board of PETA. And if you saw his long-sought interview with former President Obama near the end of his term, he asked a sitting president for what I believe was the first time it ever happened, a question dealing with animal welfare. Now, it was kind of oblique, but I've watched that clip a few times, and I think when you see it, you see Obama squirm a little bit. He looks surprised and a little bit uncomfortable with the question, so it was a good moment. I was thinking of all this, and I was reading a quote from a book written by this week's guest, and it goes like this. "If biting into a turkey drumstick on Thanksgiving isn't covered by life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, then what is?" The quote is attributed to a Richard Berman. So I'm torn by this. Of course I want to get along. But I can't seem to reconcile Mr. Berman's entitlement to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness with that of the very sentient and feeling turkey. Why does Mr. Berman get to pursue his at the expense of the turkey? If Mr. Berman was at my Thanksgiving dinner and was offered a selection from the ever-growing choices of non-sentient life-destroying options, would he scoff and storm out? And if he confronted me with his little opinion of his entitlement, don't I have some kind of an obligation to defend, even at the risk of not getting along? Does it throw a wet rag over Thanksgiving just to raise it? Am I some kind of a killjoy to bring the subject up? Can't we just leave our traditions alone? Tough questions for sure as we look at the curious case of the turkey and Thanksgiving with our guest Karen Davis of United Poultry Concerns today on The Other Animals. But first, it's time for Animals in the News. All right, so the first story, my mother has this great expression. She said, it was sort of had a Yiddish people listening over from Barry's show, something we need like a hole in the head. I grew up listening to that. We need this like a hole in the head. Well, this story, we need like a hole in the head. Get this. A vegan man claims Burger King cooked its Impossible Whopper alongside meat, and he's suing. He filed suit. A class action lawsuit filed Monday in the Southern District of Florida claims that although the burger chain advertises its vegan option is meat-free, it is contaminated by meat byproduct because it's cooked on the same grill as meat products. The suit accuses Burger King of false advertising and benefiting monetarily from offering a vegan option that is, in fact, not vegan. Burger King declined to comment to several media outlets. CNN's sister network HLN has reached out to Burger King for response to the allegations in the lawsuit, but has not heard back yet. They described the website, Burger King's website, as 100% Whopper, 0% beef. For guests looking for a meat-free option, a non-broiler method of preparation is available upon request. Philip Williams, the plaintiff in the case, is a vegan who does not eat or drink anything that uses animal byproducts. He purchased an Impossible Whopper at a location in Atlanta in August after seeing advertisements and paid, quote, premium price for the meatless option, according to the lawsuit. And he claims he suffered monetary damages in the amount that he paid to purchase the Impossible Whopper. I'm not going to read the rest of it. I just want to strangle this guy. You know, you missed the point, dude. You're missing the point. The point is not that what was served on the grill. The point is that this corporation is having one of the biggest rollouts, one of the most successful things, that you've got to support it. Okay, so if they screwed up and you got something, you have sort of a true a medical issue, that's different. But all you're doing is you're giving a really lousy name. You're making this effort seem, you're trivializing it, and you're giving us all a black eye. All right, that's my little rant on that guy. Burger King, keep doing what you're doing. Okay, at least in terms of the Impossible Whopper. Next story comes to us from back in the Washington, D.C. area. This came from the Washington Post, and it's sort of similar to a story we covered about 3 months ago. Trained firearm experts will start shooting deer this week in Rock Creek Park in Washington as part of a plan to manage the population there. This came from the National Park Service. The shooting will began yesterday through March 31st, and will be conducted by biologists who are, quote, highly trained firearm experts from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They'll be working with the Park Service and U.S. Park Police. Park Service officials said that white-tailed deer are, quote, overabundant in the park and have damaged some native plants and trees. Managing them, Park Service officials said, will help protect and restore some of the natural area. The deer have become so overpopulated, experts said, because the park is a good habitat. They have no natural predators, and development has pushed them to the park as a refuge. Before 1960, there were no recorded sightings of white-tailed deer in the park, but by the early 1990s, the sightings of deer were so frequent that the park stopped recording them, park officials said on their website. In 2012, the Park Service came up with a plan to reduce the deer population to a more sustainable level. Officials said a consistent deer population density of 15 to 20 per square mile is needed to allow regeneration in a healthy forest. In the past decade, the deer population at Rock Creek Park has reached nearly 100 per square mile at its peak, according to the Park Service. Quote, without continued management, deer populations would quickly rebound and again eat tree seedlings and other plants before they could grow, a Park Service statement said. So this is one of these, again, really, what is our role in this? Is it really our role to go in and shoot them? Is it who is really benefiting? How did they get there? It's the never ending question. What we are really supposed to do? All right, and of course we can't let a week go by without. This is truly, I got to tell you, just as we look at this body of work for the last 9 months here, literally, I'm not exaggerating, almost every week we have a new company getting into the plant-based food offerings. It's truly remarkable. We're really living through a historic time. This week it was Quiznos. Quiznos launches a vegan corned beef, and they're trying it out in Denver. Let's see. So this came out last week. Vegan corned beef from Mrs. Goldfarb's. Who they're asking? Mrs. Goldfarb's Unreal Deli. It's going to debut in the Denver area locations at Quiznos. And the vegan meat, available at the chain for a limited time, will be featured on a new plant-based corned beef sandwich, along with pickles, sauerkraut, dairy-based Swiss cheese. I have a hunch they're going to offer the non-dairy base, and honey French dressing. That kills it, too. Honey French dressing on a Quiznos bun of choice. Oh, okay, here we go. To make it vegan, customers can order the sandwich without the cheese and honey French dressing on a whiter wheat bun. This is the first plant protein on Quiznos menus, and if successful, it will be rolled out to locations nationwide. Given customers' growing desire for meatless options and the rise of plant-based foods, we wanted to test this modern twist on a deli classic here in Denver, where sustainable green lifestyles are thriving. Sheila Zimmerman, Vice President of Marketing for Quiznos, said, Miss Goldfarb's Unreal Deli is a delicious alternative to traditional deli meat and a perfect brand fit. On November 17th, 2 days after the Quiznos launch, Unreal Deli founder Jenny Goldfarb will appear on investment reality show Shark Tank, where she will attempt to entice one or more of the sharks to partner with her fast-growing family business. Oh, she gets a deal. Without her first year of business, within her first year of business, Gold Farm expanded the distribution of her vegan corned beef to 58 Whole Foods markets in the Southern Pacific region, as well as select traditional delis and grocery stores in Los Angeles. The Unreal Deli Vegan Corned Beef now ships nationwide and will be available in major grocery stores next year. That sounds really good. I'm really curious to see what happens. And I have a sort of a sidebar here on that. Shout out to a local similar type of deli up near where I live. It's, they don't even know I'm doing this. Moishinitsi's up in Newtown. I went up there this past week, and I was so thrilled to see they offer. This is the, you know, one of these types of you know, neighborhood delis where the corned beef and the pastrami are rampant, and they have now offered an impossible versions. They have an impossible meatloaf, and they had an impossible burger. And it was really good. They have their own little twist on how they make it, so go check them out. All right, we have time for one more quick story here. This comes sort of a similar theme to companies adding. It's not just the restaurants. It's now the airlines. This is United Airlines. They are going to start focusing heavily, the statement said, on plant-based options. They will expand its vegan options in 2020. Travelers can expect to see savory new choices like red beet hummus with roasted vegetables, roasted curry cauliflower with whipped hummus and pomegranate, and stuffed grape leaf with dolma-infused dairy-free yogurt. Cool. United Airlines is not alone. Earlier this year, major British airline Jet2 added two completely plant-based dishes to its menu. The all-day vegan breakfast features veggie sausage, potatoes, and sautéed mushrooms in tomato sauce, and the vegan Moroccan vegetable tagine is served with couscous. Customer feedback shows that there's a strong demand for vegan options, so United says they're delighted to be introducing these delicious meals, giving customers more choice on their award-winning airline. Adding to the plant-based frenzy is Norwegian Airlines and Emirates Airlines, both of which reported spikes in vegan meal orders for January of this year. Norwegian offers tasty choices like a gnocchi dish and chickpea stew, while the Emirates Catering Factory boasts more than 127 vegan recipes, including vegan mushroom ravioli, lentil and spinach ragu, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, chocolate cake, and key lime parfait. I know I'm pronouncing that right. Okay, so that's our news for today. That's mostly good. When we come back, we're going to start talking turkey with Karen Davis of United Poultry Concerns. We'll be right back.
It shouldn't happen to man's best friend, but it does. Take a drive down a country road or a city street and you'll see them. Dogs left to spend their entire lives in solitary confinement, trapped at the end of a chain or inside a small pen. There's no crueler punishment for these social pack animals who need and deserve love, companionship, scratches behind the ears, and walks around the block. Please let your dogs live inside. Make them part of the family. For more information, visit PETA.org.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have all pets house calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
And welcome back to The Other Animals, WWDB. Karen Davis, PhD, is the president and founder of United Poultry Concerns, a nonprofit organization that promotes the compassionate and respectful treatment of domestic fowl, including a sanctuary for chickens in Virginia. Inducted into the National Animal Rights Hall of Fame for outstanding contributions to animal liberation, Karen is the author of numerous books, essays, articles, and campaigns. They include A Home for Henny, Instead of Chicken, Instead of Turkey, A Poultryless Poultry Potpourri, Prison Chickens, Poisoned Eggs, An Inside Look at the Modern Poultry Industry, More Than a Meal, The Turkey in History, Myth, Ritual, and Reality. That's the one we're going to be focusing on today. And a really important book aside, The Holocaust and the Handmaid's Tale, A Case for Comparing Atrocities. Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Laurent. How are you?
Oh, terrific. So I'm glad you can make it. So it's such a, you know, the animal rights movement has just taken off in the last so many years. And it's, I don't want to say it's mainstream, but it's not such a weird thing. And I'm curious how you got into this really important niche that no other organization seemed to have focused on. This is, you know, really focusing on poultry, chickens, the bird side of it. How did you find it? How did you get into that initially?
Well, actually, in the 1980s is when I started really educating myself about animals and their exploitation. Mm-hmm. And I increasingly focused my attention on farmed animals, who represent about 95% or more of all animals exploited by human beings. So I've always had a lifelong love for birds, although I did not grow up around chickens and turkeys. Once I began reading about them and then doing an internship at what was then a fledgling organization, Farm Sanctuary in Avondale, Pennsylvania, things kind of came together for me, and my love of birds and my deep affinity for birds came together with my learning about the fact that chickens represent about 98% of, or more of all land animals being raised and slaughtered for food. Mm-hmm. So I pretty much immersed myself in the literature of factory farming, and in the late 1980s, I decided that I wanted to start an organization that would focus attention on chickens, turkeys, and ducks. So that's what I did. I started reading extensively, even more, into not only contemporary literature, but also the literature of farming going way, way back. Mm-hmm. I used to go to the Beltsville Agriculture Library in Beltsville, Maryland. It's the largest agriculture library in the world. So I had access to all of this material. And when I was pretty much decided to start United Poultry Concerns in the late 1980s, I discussed it with some of my friends in the animal advocacy movement. And by that time, I had been in the movement since about 1983. Mm-hmm. But I had two pretty polarized responses from well-meaning people. One was an organization focusing on chickens and turkeys is never going to succeed. It's just too limited, and we can't even really get people to care about whales, let alone how are we going to get them to care about chickens.
And this was in the mid-80s? Is that what you said?
Well, by this time it was the late 80s.
Late 80s, and you were getting that. All right,
yeah.
Okay, so that was one, and what was the other reaction?
So the other was from another group of people within the animal advocacy movement, and I'm talking about leaders of the movement at the time, said, please, go for it and do it now. Don't wait. So one way or the other, I was going to do this. I had already made up my mind, but I was interested in the fact that and continue to be interested in the fact that there were those who said it would never work, an organization like ours. Mm-hmm. 30 years later, here we are. Mm-hmm. Those who were very supportive and urged me not to wait, but to start the organization and just go forward,
which is what
I did.
There you go. So why don't you tell us about United Poultry Concerns, what is its mission, and maybe some of your success stories in the past 30 years.
Okay, sure. Well, United Poultry Concerns is a national nonprofit organization. We promote the compassionate and respectful treatment of chickens, turkeys, ducks, and other domesticated fowl. And by domesticated fowl, I refer to those birds who have the misfortune of being considered a food source for human beings, along with other uses. But the primary issue is the food source. Mm-hmm. One. So that's our mission. Mm-hmm. We focus on these birds in the areas of food production, science, education, entertainment, and human companionship situations. And our organization has always, from the very beginning, included a sanctuary for rescued chickens, turkeys, ducks, mm-hmm. and we also have in our sanctuary currently here in Virginia, in rural Virginia, three peafowl, one peacock and two peahens. So we have a very nice group of birds here. We have 12,000 square feet of predator-proof outdoor aviary for these birds, and with all their individual houses inside. And my opportunity to be with these birds every day, to hear their voices, the roosters crowing in the early morning hours, and just hear them out and about all day long, enjoying their lives, is certainly a huge motivation for me to do the work I do, because, as you can imagine, the work I do puts me in touch with some very sad and depressing situations. Yeah. So the birds keep, the real birds right here in our own backyard, keep me focused on what the work I do and how important it is that I and our organization continue to do it.
It's interesting with the mission of the organization and that initial reaction, that pushback you got. It strikes me, again, and as I was reading More Than a Meal, this issue, even as you were saying it just now, that what you're focusing on, and you list them, right? You said chickens and turkeys and, you know, poultry. And those words, there's a language there that I think you have an uphill battle just that. You know, if the other people said save the whales, everybody knows what a whale is. And you know, by now, nobody thinks of a whale as being stupid. But yet when you use just the words chicken and turkey, there's a lot of language baggage here for you to overcome. Even the word poultry, it just sounds you've got that to overcome. And let's maybe talk about that a little bit, like, you know, this thing, the notion of a bird brain or you know, a turkey as a flop on a Broadway show or something like that. Is that in play? You've got that whole language stigma to overcome.
Yes, it's definitely a language stigma and stigma. And it is difficult to overcome. For example, even now, occasionally, I'll hear from somebody who cares about these birds who will say, why do you call your organization United Poultry Concern?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Doesn't that mean, like, the industry?
Yeah, and, I was thinking that, too. I do. Go ahead.
Well, back in the days when I was earnestly seeking the right name for the organization I was starting, I entertained the idea of Chicken Liberation America or something like that. But what I wanted to do was to have an organization that would have a more corporate-sounding title, particularly back in those early days when we were not known, because we were, that is, outside our advocacy movement. I wanted to get some information directly from the egg industry and the chicken and turkey industry, and which I succeeded in doing, particularly from the egg industry, about their starvation of hens to manipulate egg production, called forced molting mm-hmm. of hens, where they starve them for up to 2 full weeks. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get some information from them, their thinking that our organization was an industry survey organization. And I did succeed in getting information that way, because United Poultry Concerns sounded like United Poultry Concerns. It's something like an industry group. So anyway, by now it's come to the place where, well, this is our organization, United Poultry Concerns. And personally, although I completely understand what you're saying about how people in general look at and hear the word poultry, I actually like the word. I think it's a nice word. Uh-huh. It's sort of warm, and it just has a nice feel to it to me. But there's so many ways of looking at everything. But I just have to say this, Laurent, really quickly for everybody. The idea that people have that chickens and turkeys are somehow stupid or that they're dirty is 100% false. It's a complete misimpression, misunderstanding of who these birds are. They're not stupid at all, and I have to say that one thing I have discovered through the years of researching and writing about these birds, and much of my work has looked at the what the poultry scientists and ornithologists and, you know, various avian researchers have to say, is that it is now understood amongst the best of the scientists, mm-hmm. the animal and poultry scientists, that that chickens and turkeys are very intelligent birds. They're very emotional. They're cognitively very complex. And I can tell you that back in the mid-1990s, when I was at that Beltsville Agriculture Library sitting in the stacks, I happened to come across a book I had not heard of before called The Development of Behavior in the Chicken by a scientist, an avian scientist named Leslie J. Rogers. And I sat on the floor of the stacks in the library, and I started reading through it. And she made the point very emphatically, with all the research that she accumulated and presents in her book, in the development of brain and behavior in the chicken, that chickens in particular and birds in general are every bit as intelligent as mammals are, and there is simply no excuse to treat these birds in a way that diminishes their opportunity for a varied and satisfying existence. So,
I've always had this thing that people use that the judgment of intelligence. It's almost like an excuse, it's this bizarre abused barometer. Let's just say, for instance, that they were right, that the chickens and turkeys, they're not math geniuses. So what? Why do we have to use intelligence as an excuse? Well, if they're not smart, it's a way to judge them. They're right. If they're not smart, then we can do with them whatever we want. Right.
Well, we could think that way and have talked and thought that way with regard to certain human groups who have been judged to be inferior.
Right.
So that kind of an argument, as soon as you think about it analogously, we realize that using what we call smart or intelligent, first of all, it's very arbitrary.
Exactly.
And secondly, as you say, that's basically saying that if somebody has less defensive, less ability to defend themselves, in this case through intelligent behavior and understanding, therefore we have more of a right to abuse those who are less able to defend themselves.
Right.
And that's a pretty caddish attitude to have.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, no creatures can exist in this world navigating the complexities of environment, of parenthood, and all of the things that chickens and turkeys, like other animals, evolved in nature to do. No animals can do that and be stupid. So the idea that animals are some animals are stupid, who have lived for tens of thousands of years raising their families, even stable environments have novelty every single day, and every animal has to be alert to those novelties. So most people aren't thinking at all. They're just sort of echoing things they've heard without any basis in real evidence or understanding of what they're saying.
Yeah.
And we seek to remedy that very serious problem.
All right, you started to talk about, and I want to sort of get to this stuff before we get over to the turkeys, but it's not just the treatment of the chickens, turkeys, but this whole thing with the egg industry. I wonder if you could spend a few minutes on that. There's this, you go into the grocery store now, and I would say it's sort of a mixed bag at the moment, where you see this concept of free range or humane raised, or you go to the cartons and some they're brown, and they show pictures of the chickens running around in the what looks to be this beautiful open natural pasture, and they're selling. I mean, these companies are doing okay as a result of touching this, hitting this cord, but we know the reality is it still ain't rainbows and sunshine for these chickens. But it seems to be awakening. If you could talk about the humane or free range movement and what the reality is of the egg production.
Most of the hens who are used for egg production remain in little wire cages, battery cages.
Mm-hmm.
They're in buildings which have cages from your feet to over your head, and that has to be the worst environment that you could ever inflict on any living creature. So they can't really move.
Mm-hmm.
They can't really exercise their bodies. And the places are filthy because you've got all these creatures all squashed into this this huge building. And just like with human beings, when you do that, you have all kinds of filth derive and also all kinds of pathogens, disease-causing organisms floating all over the place. So it's a horrible situation. But in the past 15 years or so, there has been a movement to get hens out of the battery cages. Battery referring to individual units that are all alike, lined up or stacked up and all alike. So that's why they're called battery cages. But And I've been in many of these places, so I know what they're like. And I know that you're so nauseated when you're in those places, and there's so much ammonia
everyone
from
I've
the droppings that you can hardly even breathe in those
burns
places.
Burns your eyes, yeah.
You can't even believe the burning in your eyes and your throat, and that living birds are living in every conceivable kind of misery just to produce eggs. So for human beings who don't need an egg anyway, but to move on, there has been this very concerted effort to get, at least to get the hens out of the battery cages. So the movement within the egg industry has been increasingly toward what is called cage-free egg production. That is where the hens are not literally in little wire cages, but they are totally confined in very crowded buildings. They never go outside. They are not free-ranged. They're called cage-free, and they're very crowded, as I say. The atmosphere in these kinds of places necessarily has that atmosphere, which is dense with, skin that comes off your, think of human beings, that, you know, your skin flakes off, things are coming off your body that you can't clean. Yes. And I always remind people how horrible it is for birds like chickens and turkeys, for example, who spend a lot of time preening their feathers to be clean, who love to take dust baths, which for them is comparable to a human water bath. It's how they practice bodily hygiene. It's how they keep their feathers in very good condition. And all of this is they're deprived of in these cages and in these cage-free environments. So the cage-free is less cruel, less inhumane than the caged environment, but it's not really humane, and it really is... it is cruel because the needs of the birds are simply not met. Their nature and their needs do not find proper happiness, expression, and well-being in these kinds of environments. Mm-hmm. So we had a campaign not too long ago. Part of an ongoing campaign where we looked at, for example, the National Public Radio station in Washington, D.C., which was actually promoting the company Nelly's Eggs, and they weren't just mentioning them as a sponsor, but they were actually promoting them.
Right, they're one of the ones that have the picture with the little girl holding the hen, and it just looks
idyllic. Well, false advertising is just basically what it is. Mm-hmm. So,
what's the reality? That's my point. Like, so you see that picture, and you think, oh, these are just ask for more.
Pete and Jerry's?
Pete and Jerry's is another one, right?
The parent company. Yeah. And, and PETA, by the way, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, has sued Pete and Jerry's for false advertising. So the reality is that Pete and Jerry's hens, and this was also reported by Peter Singer and Jim Mason back in 2006 in their book, Food Matters, in which they visited one of Pete and Jerry's hen operations in, I think it was in New Hampshire, and what they saw was that these so-called, and they were being advertised as free-range. Free-range meaning that the birds have to have some kind of certified U.S. Department of Agriculture access to the outdoors. And what they found were these long, low buildings filled, very crowded with hens, each of whom had about 1 square foot to 1.5 square feet of living space per bird, and they never went outside.
Yeah.
And Pete and Jerry said, well, you know, we're concerned that if a wild bird flies overhead onto the field has bird flu virus that could infect our flock. But here's the thing. These things are just pretty much made up because What these farmers want to do and what these producers want to do is they want everything to be super easy. And when you have birds outside, gathering their eggs is an act of labor. You have to gather the eggs. You have to find where the birds may have secluded their eggs. So they just want everything automated indoors.
Yep.
So they come up with excuses about bird flu and whatnot, but what it really is they just want, they want to have to employ as little labor as possible, laborers.
Yep, yep.
They don't, you know, they just want to maximize their output and minimize their input, so that's what they do. So they lie to the public. Yep. That's just what they do.
Okay, Karen, hey,
but we were happy to say, we were happy to report that the NPR station, WAMU 88.5, serving the Washington, D.C. area, did respond to our request that they remove those promotional ads for Nellie's Eggs, and they did that.
Good.
And they wrote a very nice email to me explaining that they were, you know, that they researched our concerns and found that we were correct.
There's
and
a success
so they
story. All right,
removed
excellent.
The, they stopped advertising Nellie's Eggs
excellent.
On that NPR station.
Okay. All right, Karen, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, listen, if you want to get involved in the conversation, feel free to give us a call, 888-329-3306. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
It shouldn't happen to man's best friend, but it does. Take a drive down a country road or a city street and you'll see them. Dogs left to spend their entire lives in solitary confinement, trapped at the end of a chain or inside a small pen. There's no crueler punishment for these social pack animals who need and deserve love, companionship, scratches behind the ears, and walks around the block. Please let your dogs live inside. Make them part of the family. For more information, visit PETA.org.
That's just the way it is. Some things will never change. That's just the way it is.
All right, welcome back to The Other Animals on WB. We're talking with Karen Davis of United Poultry Concerns. I picked that little piece of music because our next big subject here is, of course, the topic of the day, which is turkeys and Thanksgiving. And I thought, you know, that this is, seems to me, this is, some things will never change. We're really up against it here. That turkeys are so associated with Thanksgiving that is probably one of the biggest uphill battles. So, Karen, how did turkeys get associated with Thanksgiving? What's the background on that?
Well, actually, throughout the 19th century and even into the 20th century, Thanksgiving was often not celebrated at all. And it was Abraham Lincoln who finally deferred to requests to establish a national holiday, a national Thanksgiving holiday, he did. But again, the idea of the turkey being part of Thanksgiving is something that sort of happened gradually. And it was really in the 20th century under Harry Truman, President Harry Truman, and on through subsequent presidents into a turkey industry producer would simply give a slaughtered bird to the president, and there might be some kind of a little ceremony or whatnot. But then it evolved into a turkey producer bringing a live turkey and a so-called backup turkey to the White House to be in this mock ceremony that evolved further into a pardoning of the turkey. And by the way, in my book, More Than a Meal, The Turkey in History, Myth, Ritual, and Reality, I have an entire chapter devoted to the turkey pardoning ceremony.
And I want to talk about that, by the way. So I want to get into that.
So it was really, what's his name here? JFK, President John Kennedy. Mm-hmm. He had said something about when the press corps asked him about whether what he was going to do with his turkey or turkeys once the ceremony was over, and he says something like he just wanted them to kind of live on the White House grounds. I don't think that actually lasted very long, but in any case, that's what he said. But it was under Ronald Reagan when the Iran-Contra scandal was taking place, and the press corps was asking him, firing questions at him about the various players in that particular scandal. Mm-hmm. And being an actor, Reagan was able to cleverly kind of divert every answer to this poor turkey who was being on a lectern or on a table in the White House Rose Garden. So he kept saying, you know, they were asking him, these reporters were saying, well, are you going to pardon so-and-so? Are you going to pardon Oliver North? Are you going to pardon this guy and that guy who had participated in the scandal? And Reagan would respond.
He's going to pardon the turkey.
About like how he was going to pardon the turkey, the turkey who was sitting
and that's
right
how it started,
there.
Huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's kind of started the pardoning part of the turkey. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, though, that maybe 15 years ago, I learned that where they would send the two turkeys, very heavy, very large, heavy turkeys, was to a place called Frying Pan Park in Northern Virginia outside Washington, D.C. And so I decided to go there and actually see these turkeys because we had heard that they were very they were just neglected. They were not being treated properly or even paid any attention to. And sure enough, when I visited with a colleague, we were taken way to the end of Frying Pan Park to this little mud hut where there were these two huge, must have weighed 50 pounds each, miserable male turkeys. Just there in the mud. I mean, they were totally neglected, and they were just so heavy and so miserable. It was just a horrible sight. So, of course, you know, we spoke with the manager and whoever else was there, and they promised that they were going to make better living conditions for the turkeys. And nobody visited the turkeys. They were way in
a
far distant part of the park, and they were just there, like, waiting to die, is essentially what was
going on,
in a filthy, muddy mess. So about 2 weeks later, they called me and said, well, we fixed up the place, and the turkeys are much better cared for and happier, so why don't you come on out and have a look at them? So I did.
And
guess what?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, they resubstituted the original turkeys with two young turkeys.
And you weren't supposed to know that.
And tried to pass them off as the original turkeys.
No.
That's what they did. And you know, in the news media,
yesterday.
As I discussed in my book, More Than a Meal, you always have all this sarcasm and
mean-spirited
venom directed at turkeys, like a kind of foreplay leading up to the actual Thanksgiving Day dinner.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you about that because in the book you mentioned you actually compare it to. Sort of a national sacrificial blood ritual, which is a really fascinating argument. And then you sort of wrap it up that we have to create laughingstocks and innocent victims in order to be thankful. I was just wondering if you could talk about that. That's a really fascinating. You're touching on the national conscious that this is some strange, ancient, unifying. Process that a large entity like a country can go through that, but it's goes back to our really primitive roots to do this blood ritual, but also make them laughingstocks somehow. I wonder if you could talk about that for a minute.
Well, as I discussed in More Than a Meal, I see the turkey, the Thanksgiving turkey, in what I call the carnivalesque. Tradition, that is the carnival tradition, where you participate like Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
You're examples of that have gone on since time immemorial, where you throw away all the pieties and all the reverence for whatever, and you just undertake an irreverent and bawdy and sarcastic. Approach to bodies and life and sex and eating and everything else. And how I looked at the turkey, or how I discussed the turkey at Thanksgiving in my book, is as on the one hand, you have all the sort of solemn piety about Thanksgiving and Plymouth Rock and, you know, all that humorless piety that we're obligated to feel. Yeah. And it seems that there's this need to create, you know, the other side of that kind of mentality, which is the side that mocks and ridicules and laughs at innocent victims, victims who cannot defend themselves, and at one another. But there is this scapegoating that takes place.
What is there about human nature that is so, that needs that? What is that?
Well, as you said, I mean, there are many primitive impulses in human beings. And I'll just read you one quick line here from a book that's quite interesting that I learned a lot from by a writer named Margaret Visser, V-I-S-S-E-R, called The Rituals of Dinner. And actually, I used this statement from her book as the, like a motto at the beginning of my book. She says, "Nothing so unites us gathering with one mind to murder someone we hate unless it is coming together to share in a meal." And I think that's a fascinating way of looking at a lot of things, including the poor Thanksgiving turkey. Again, I'll read it quickly. She says, nothing so, and she, by us, she means us as a species or as a nation or a family or whatever. Mm. Nothing so unites us as gathering with one mind to murder someone we hate unless it is coming together to share a meal. So what brings us together, she's saying, most effectively is hatred and eating.
But it's touching on this concept of a common enemy. Nothing, you know, I was talking about in the introduction, you know, the reality of, it's sort of the sad reality right now that the country is incredibly divided, certainly as divided as I can remember in my lifetime. I would imagine it's only surpassed maybe by Civil War era, but, you know, people are even talking about that. And the context there, what you just said, is that, well, what would be the one thing that would unite us? If a war, right? If we had to have a common enemy, if we all had to pull together for, you know, whatever, for our own survival, that would pull us together. And you could even take that, extrapolate that a step further, and some have that. So if the common enemy were, you know, a European foe or whatever, what if we were visited by the proverbial aliens and the entire planet had to you know, gather together and fight off that common enemy? We'd be united because we'd have that common foe. I mean, that would be half of the equation that you're talking about there with the common enemy. It doesn't have the meal component, but it seems like in the absence of that common enemy, we're just going to tear each other apart. You know, we're going to find this thing. And so the symbolism, I think what you're saying in that quote is that somehow the common enemy becomes the turkey.
First of all, we have limited time here, I realize, and the role of the turkey in the Thanksgiving ritual is pretty complex. I mean, first of all, I argue in my book that, and others have said so too, that human beings are very ambivalent about being animals. They're very ambivalent about thinking of themselves or being thought of as an animal. In fact, people resist that.
Well, the title of the show is specifically with that in mind, The Other Animals. That's exactly why I call it.
I think that most people do not experience themselves as an animal, and they don't want to.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of resentment toward, you know, animals, non-human animals, because humans want to be in a separate sphere, separate from the rest of the living world. And there's a lot of resentment toward being an animal, having a body that and being in the flesh that suffers and dies like every other animal. And so, as we see throughout human history, humans are always creating what could be called another world to live in, another world, a world that's going to be for us exclusively in the next world.
Yeah, we have souls, and they don't have souls.
Or another world to live in within our imaginations, mm-hmm. That we create all kinds of trappings through religion and so on, mm-hmm. to be other than earthly beings who are kin to the other animals of this world. So there's a lot of resentment that is directed against other animals, even though many people care about animals, or at least, people are ambivalent about their animality and about the animals we share the world with. And what we tend to do is to select some animals that we care about and even, shower all kinds of care on, and then other animals are not valued, are not considered to be worthy of even existence in some cases. So it's unfortunate that turkeys, who have such a, they're such a dramatic bird. I don't know yeah. quite what the word is, but they're such a, the way they look, the way they behave, male turkeys especially, their gobbling, their behavior, that kind of is comical to mm-hmm. People. And through when the Europeans came to the what became America back in the 16th century, there were turkeys everywhere on the continent, in South America, Central America, North America. Turkeys were everywhere. And the Europeans had never seen a turkey before, because turkeys apparently are native only to this continent. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of question about mm-hmm. why they even named the turkey, which we don't have time to get into, yeah. but I mm-hmm. do discuss that in the book. But the point is, they saw the turkey, and especially the male turkey, as comical. At the same time, the explorers, so-called, the invaders, all of them, these military troops and so on, would often write letters and memoirs in which they would describe how interesting turkeys were, both the females and the males. And one of the things that really did turkeys in, to the extent that they were finally virtually exterminated by the beginning of the 20th century, was the fact that turkeys are very curious about things. And they will come right up to a campfire, and they will come right up to your fence post. And what John Jay Audubon and all of these people did was they got out their muskets or whatever kind of weapon they had, and they shot them all. Yeah. They thought it was great fun when the turkeys would be roosting for as wide a space as a whole mile in the trees at night. Mm. They loved to go and just start shooting them in the trees.
A sad indictment.
That's what they called a turkey... A live turkey shoot.
Karen, I'm really sorry we're out of time. We could go on. It's really fascinating. We have to take a break. Again, this is Karen Davis, United Poultry Concerns, a series of books, just three of them, Instead of Chicken, Instead of Turkey, A Poultryless Poultry Potpourri, Prison Chicken, Poison Eggs, and the big one, Inside More Than a Meal, The Turkey in History, Myth, Ritual, and Reality. I hardly recommend any or all of them. Thanks, Karen. We'll be right back with Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart and nice. Our vet takes such good care of us, but would rather stay home. Would rather be home to catch mice.
And we're back on The Other Animals, and we're joined now by Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls. Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Hey, very well. Happy pre-Thanksgiving.
Happy pre-Thanksgiving. Yeah. So I'm curious, all this talk about Thanksgiving meal, it tends to be a period where not only we human animals overeat, but it's a bounty for the pets in the house. And is that a problem where we're giving scraps that they wouldn't normally get? I think the problem is probably more for dogs than cats, but it's anything
all
goes.
All of the above.
All of the above, right?
Absolutely. It's one of the most dangerous times of the year, the holidays in general. And you know, I vets in general, and I myself, of course, as well, really try to warn people, particularly turkey. It's just specific foods. A lot of animals, particularly dogs, are very sensitive in the stomach to turkey, and they'll vomiting and diarrhea will definitely result in a lot of them. A lot of visits to the hospital because of this. So yeah, and then the other problem is you as an owner might know that your dog or cat or any other pet shouldn't be eating certain things, but your guests, if you have Thanksgiving at your house or any other holiday, they are the
hero over. Yeah. And then just
they're the ones sneaking stuff to your pet.
To your pet, yeah. Taking it with the best of intentions, right? So
and then they'll deny it.
Yeah. Guilty as charged. But what do they get? The funny thing is, you know, with cats, if they don't, cats seem to have, and we were just talking about intelligence, and if they don't, you can't give a cat like the weird marshmallowed sweet potato stuff, right? They'll just sniff at it and walk away and get this
well,
out of here.
There are definitely weird cats that will eat almost anything.
Oh, yeah.
Your dogs.
But the dog seems less discriminate. They'll just woof anything. No pun intended. They'll just.
Yeah, generally speaking, probably. Although I've put down so many things. I've had dogs in the past where if you put down a potato chip, I mean, forget it. You get your hand taken. Whereas my dog, I'll put it down. He just looks at it and it just walks away in disgust. It just depends.
So,
but yeah, generally speaking, a lot of them will take almost anything. And if they like it the best, if it's probably not good for them.
The irony. So how do you treat them? I mean, did they actually bring them in with bad gastro issues around this time?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, certainly. I mean, you know, when your pet has a problem with, you know, gastrointestinal upset with vomiting or diarrhea, that becomes a whole household problem. So, and not to mention they can get pretty darn sick from it and feel terrible. And another thing you have to watch out, particularly bones of the turkey, going back to turkey, getting into your trash bags and trash cans. Excuse me, a lot of them will end up in the hospital just from foreign body type problems where they literally might have to get surgery because those bones particularly are brittle and they get broken up by their teeth and their body and they get sharp shards inside of them and they can cut right through their intestines and stuff. So
how about
you
choking?
Can suddenly be looking at $10,000 of surgery.
Oh my God. You have a choking hazard too, right? Couldn't the bone get
that too?
Right.
That too. Cats and dogs both will go for that sort of stuff and they don't know.
Yeah. Are there certain sort of focusing on the dogs? Are there certain? And we always know sort of the chocolate that seems to be the real no-no. Is there anything really that you would advise people to really keep your eye on their guests too to make sure they're not sneaking down there? What would be like the
nuts? There some animals can have real problems with that choking hazard. They don't chew them usually. They can get bound up in their intestines and cause blockages. Again, $10,000 of their surgery and hospitalization later. I mean, these things, they're not necessarily, it's cute, I gave the dog or cat something. Sometimes it really can cause a major life-threatening problem. Yeah. Or, again, even at the very least, vomiting and diarrhea.
Yeah, that's no fun for anyone.
A very fun problem to have for either you or your pet.
All right. Excellent. Good words of advice, words of wisdom. And think of Thanksgiving, think of diarrhea. Here we go. All right. I want to thank my guest. I want to thank my guest, Karen Davis. Special shout out to Jason Duffy, my engineer. As always, want to hear from you. If you've got ideas, comments, interested in advertising on The Other Animals, just head on over to theotheranimals.com. Don't forget to check out our partner podcasters at iroarpod.com. Next week, you will not want to miss this. I am telling you, I landed the big fish here. Ingrid Newkirk, the one and only Ingrid Newkirk, founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. That's right, PETA. She will be with me on the show. I don't think you want to miss it. Have a great Thanksgiving, everyone. We'll see you then.